Because right now I want to introduce our very special guest, Mr. Henry Lamb, who is with an organization known as EcoLogic, and he deals with how the environmental movement is being used to bring us under this new global governance. And he's written a wonderful new treatise. It's called The Rise of Global Governance, A Chronology of the 20th Century. Henry, how did you happen to write that?
Well, I had many, many inquiries about how all of the various pieces of the international puzzle fit together. And it seemed to me that the best way to answer those questions would be to put together a concise chronology of events that take us from the early part of this century right through the last UN meeting that was held in Geneva in July.
And, of course, this whole idea is we're moving towards a global government. It's a long-range plan. And despite the fact that those people who are planted within the networks, people like Rush Limbaugh and many of the local talk show hosts who sort of scoff at the idea that anybody would want global government, that would want a government of the world, this indeed is a reality which you beautifully document in this. And, of course, one only has to see what's happening in Australia as they're picking up the guns there, and our local community all across the state. Each city council is passing new legislation on restricting Saturday night specials, whatever they are, and the pressure at the state and the local level to do away with semi-automatic weapons, all part of this move to disarm the population in preparation for the coming world dictatorship. Because it's really going to be a dictatorship, isn't it, Henry?
It certainly will be. It is the classic central command and control out of a United Nations system.
Now, the United Nations system, though, is long-term planning. Why don't you start at the very beginning? Because that's what you do in this very excellent treatise. Incidentally, our listeners, we're going to be offering this here at Radio Liberty. But it really starts back at the turn of the century. And, of course, this is a long-range dream by men who are basically energized with this idea of bringing about world government to the Christian. They recognize, of course, that this is basically a Luciferian movement, and the Luciferians in America and throughout the world have always really wanted the world government. But a lot of men energized by these same goals and ideas have been working really since the inception of time. But right now, during our lifetime, these ideas are coming to fruition. So why don't you start at the time of the beginning of their century, the moving towards the First World War, and the reasons behind the war, how that was going to bring on the world government, the war to end all wars, the League of Nations, and just pick up the chronology from there.
Okay. I should say that in order to keep this report brief, and it is 38 pages, and it is concise, but in order to do so, we picked up the study with the beginning of this century. Now, we have traced the One World Government initiative much, much further back than that, but of contemporary importance is we picked up with a novel written by one Colonel Edward Mandel House. The novel was entitled Philip Drew, Administrator. And in this novel, Edward or Colonel House illustrated how he thought the world ought to be under the rule of a single government, under the rule of a single man. He said, in fact, that it was his dream to pursue socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx, flavored with a touch of religion. Now, in this novel, he actually described the creation of a world government that he called the League of Nations. Now, Philip Drew was not just a novelist. He was also Woodrow Wilson's chief aide. Woodrow Wilson referred to him in his documents as his own alter ego.
In fact, having read the history of that time and spent many weeks going through Colonel House's papers back at Yale University, it's very apparent that Colonel House had almost a mystical control over the President of the United States. Certainly the President was doing his bidding, and it always intrigued me why that was.
It is uncanny, and I don't know that historians will ever sort out the exact relationship there, but it certainly was a situation where Mandel House operated through President Wilson.
Right.
Wilson's 14 points were actually Mandel House's 14 points. And the proposal for the League of Nations was drafted by Colonel House.
And it's almost as if Woodrow Wilson was a mannequin or a puppet for this evil little conspirator, Colonel Edward Mandel House.
Yes. Now, it is important to know that in his capacity as chief aide to the president at that time, Colonel House traveled frequently to Europe and participated in virtually all of the meetings with the heads of state. Now, there was a group of people called the Inquiry who were similar to House in other governments that were on the periphery. There were a number of people in this country and a number of people in other countries who were advisors to the heads of state. But nonetheless, the League of Nations was created. It was accepted with applause in most of the world, and in fact, the Palais des Nations, or the Palace of the Nations, was built in Geneva, Switzerland, to house the world headquarters of the League of Nations. And all was going great until the U.S. Senate failed to ratify the Charter for the League of Nations. That was a crushing blow to Woodrow Wilson and to Mandel House. Wilson died 4 years later, and incidentally the same year that Lenin died in 1924. But Mandel House was not deterred. He was disappointed. But he called together his friends in the Inquiry in London, and they decided that before a world government could be accepted by the United States, that a massive educational campaign would have to be undertaken to educate Americans in particular, but the rest of the world too, in the benefits of a one-world government. So they decided to create two organizations for the purpose of educating the United States and Europe. And in London, the organization that they created was called the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And in New York, the organization was called the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations published a book, a magazine, called Foreign Affairs. That was the primary instrument for disseminating information and educating the public. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations selected its membership carefully and was, for all intents and purposes, a secret organization. And members of the State Department were selected from the Council on Foreign Relations.
And they really have been ever since. We're going to have to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back with Mr. Henry Lamb discussing this fascinating book, The Rise of Global Governance. Well, of course, this is Dr. Stan. We're back here on Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mr. Henry Lamb of Echologic, and we're going to tell you how to get in touch with his organization a little later in our program, because he puts out a great deal of excellent material on the environment. And, of course, he has attended many of these international conferences where your future and the future of your children are being planned by the elitists, by those people who feel that they know what's best for us common people. And, of course, it has to do with controlling cars, controlling production of electricity. The first world countries must dramatically cut back on fossil fuel emissions, which means the deindustrialization of America, people thrown out of work. But that's all right, because people out of work in third world countries, and we want everybody in the world to be equal under this coming world government. Of course, it's described in the Bible. If you're a Christian, you know that these things are have been talked about for many years. But what's so exciting is we're seeing it come to fruition at this time. And of course, we were talking about the League of Nations, about the Inquiry, which met in Paris back in 1919 at the Majestic Hotel, and of course, attending that were people like Alan Dulles, who formed the Central Intelligence Agency, which became part of this whole power structure, using the power of your tax money and of America's military might to force all countries in the world into this move towards world government. So you pick up the story at that point, Henry.
All right. By the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected in 1932, the Council on Foreign Relations had pretty well dominated the State Department and most of the administration of the government. And within 2 weeks after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, at the suggestion of Secretary of State Cordell Hull, President Roosevelt appointed what was called the Presidential Advisory Committee on Post-War Foreign Policy. It was a committee of 14 members, 10 of which were also members of the Council on Foreign Relations. It was this committee that actually drafted the plans for the United Nations. And, of course, in 1945, the United Nations Charter was presented in San Francisco, and Alger Hiss was the first acting Secretary General of the United Nations.
Now, that's the same Alger Hiss who was the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the same Alger Hiss who had been a communist espionage agent and was convicted of perjury for denying it, and the recent releases that they've gotten out of Russia show that he was a communist espionage agent. There was no question of it. A member of the Council on Foreign Relations, president of the Carnegie Foundation, and, of course, the first acting Secretary General of this world government body that was wanted both by the communists and by our socialist elitists.
That's exactly right. Barry Goldwater, back in 1962, wrote a book called Why Not Victory? And in that book, he was reflecting on how the United Nations Charter was ratified. And he quotes a representative from the State Department who came before the Senate committee and assured them that in no sense did the United Nations constitute any form of world government, and that the Senate need not be concerned.
Of course, the whole idea, it was never to be a world government, just like we're telling us now. We're not going to take away your cars. You've got nothing to worry about. We don't intend to destroy America's industrial capacity by limiting the output of power, but that's not what they say among themselves, is it really?
No, it certainly is not. As a matter of fact, 5 years after the Senate heard that testimony from the State Department, James Warburg appeared before a Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he said, and I'm quoting, "We shall have world government whether or not you like it, by conquest or consent."
And of course, his father had been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and these people were all intent upon world government.
Absolutely. It has been the plan from word one to create world government. Of course, now there was a variety of events that occurred between 1945 and 1990 that slowed the process, and we outline and document virtually all of that in this report. But to get us up to speed a little quicker, I want to jump to 1980, that decade where the environmental movement was in its heyday, and we were totally unaware that the environmental movement had any relationship at all to the United Nations. But the United Nations was quite busy during the decade of the 80s. There were three world commissions that operated during that time that are of extreme significance. One was the Palm Commission, Olof Palm from Sweden, headed a commission having to do with disarmament. There was, and I'll come back to that. There was another commission headed by Willy Brandt that had to do with development. And there was a third commission that met in 1987 headed by Gro Harlem Brundtland, called the Brundtland Commission. And at the time, she was vice president of the World Socialist International. But those three commissions had enormous impact on domestic policy and the shape of world events. The Palm Commission, the idea that the United Nations should be the only military force on earth powerful enough to deter wars between nations was actually developed and presented. Now, that was followed, some other events in this country, which we talk about. President Kennedy helped quite a bit with his document on world peace, but world peace at that time was the excuse used to get power to the UN and diminish power in the United States and other countries.
Now, that document you're talking about is State Department document 7247 on the disarmament of the American public and then the transfer of United Nations American troop control to the United Nations.
That's exactly right. And that policy is still in effect, and that policy is being implemented on a daily basis just as rapidly as it can be.
And that's why our troops are in Macedonia, that's why our troops are in Bosnia, and the United Nations operations, even though they haven't told the American public our troops are in Bosnia, after a United Nations resolution allowing them to go or sending them.
That's correct. And it is the objective of the United Nations, as revealed in their most recent report, by the Commission on Global Governance, Our Global Neighborhood, to place under the authority of the United Nations all manufacture, sale, and distribution of all firearms.
Right.
Not only military weapons, but handguns as well. That initiative is still afoot. Now, those commissions that met in the 1980s, particularly the Brundtland Commission that met in 1987, introduced to the world the concept of sustainable development. And in that document called Our Common Future, the idea of integrating the environment, economic development, and education were presented, and that concept flourished. And it was out of that concept that grew the 1992 World Conference on Environment and Development in Rio, that brought together more people for an environmental rally than has ever been brought together before, some 40,000 people and 105 heads of state. And it was at that meeting that the Convention on Biodiversity was presented, and the Convention on Climate Change was presented, and Agenda 21 was presented. And all of those documents have just absolutely profound impact on this country.
And of course, even though we haven't necessarily ratified the treaty, President Clinton is implementing all of these programs. And wasn't Maurice Strong the man who was in charge of that conference?
Yes.
And of course, he is a well-known occultist. He's the fellow with the 100,000 acres up there in Colorado. If you ever read Frank Peretti's book, Piercing the Darkness, and those two books, you'll remember the race to get to Colorado. And of course, Peretti was really describing one of the leading occultists in the world today, Maurice Strong.
Maurice Strong is probably the single most influential individual in the world as it relates to environmental policy.
And he's openly written about how we've just got to take the cars away from people. We've got to cut back on living standards. In fact, there are too many people in the world.
He has said all of that. He has declared air conditioning to be unsustainable, single-family homes, convenience foods, golf courses. He has declared in public session all of those things to be unsustainable, and they must go. And he is not just another voice crying in the wilderness. He was the Secretary General of the first Earth Summit in 1972. He was the first Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Program. He was the Secretary General of the Earth Conference in Rio in 1992. He was the founder of the Earth Council, which is now coordinating sustainable development plans in more than 100 nations. He is also currently chairman of the board of the World Resources Institute and a consultant to the World Bank. His office is six blocks from the White House, and he and Al Gore co-chair a White House task force on appropriate technology. Many people see him to be the prime candidate to replace Boutros-Ghali as the Secretary General of the United Nations.
I think that's so interesting you mentioned that, Henry, because the average individual out here, you know, the common people, I never told that, but I certainly agree with you that he's the sleeper. We keep hearing maybe it's got to be Gorbachev and maybe it's going to be George Bush. But certainly one, in my estimation, one of the most sinister and dangerous men who will be ultimately one of the leaders of this coming one-world government, or certainly strongly associated with, is Maurice Strong. We're going to have to take a quick break here, and we want to tell our listeners that we are carrying the book we're talking about today. It's really a very simple, straightforward book. It's got, it's well done. It's large type, but it has all the quotations and all of the various references beautifully laid out so that you can read this through, you can get the references, and if anybody says there's no move towards world government, you can counter this. It's called The Rise of Global Governance, A Chronology of the 20th Century, probably the best thing I've ever read, concise and to the point, and of course it's available. You can call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-448-927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. Our form of government, our way of life, is under attack today by these people who are dedicated to the establishment of the occultic world governance system. So call right now and ask for a copy of Henry Lamb's The Rise of Global Governance. They really say at that as far as what was going to have to be done to stop global warming. What do they really intend to do as far as fossil fuel emissions for first world countries such as America?
They intend to develop a protocol, an internationally legally binding regulation requiring developed countries to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions to a level 20% below 1990 levels. Now, most economists and scientists translate that to mean a reduction of fossil fuel energy in the range of 60 to 80% over the next 9 years. That is just a profound objective. Well, I can't even imagine how in our little business a reduction of 60% of energy use could even be possible.
Well, of course, that's why they have to get the cars off the road, because there's no way to cut back on the energy, on fossil fuel emissions if we have all these people driving cars on the highways.
That's right.
And, of course, we're being told by our legislators, well, the government says we have to do it or that we're not going to get any money for highways. Well, we don't need money for highways because there's not going to be that many cars out there.
Well, it is a well-coordinated plan. You see the initiative out there in California to get cars off the highway. There is another initiative under the President's Council on Sustainable Development to build what is called sustainable communities, where bike paths and pedestrian walkways and mass transit is used. There is still another initiative by the Natural Resources Defense Council, along with the United Nations, to create a World Car Summit to set forth a whole series of regulations penalizing fossil fuel or internal combustion engines and subsidizing alternative energy transportation vehicles. It is a coordinated effort, and it's all part and parcel of the global governance agenda.
Okay, well, let's go to Henry here. Hi, Henry.
That's Mike.
Oh, Mike. Okay, Mike.
Yeah.
Okay.
Henry's the other one.
Okay.
I wanted to ask Mr. Lamb about a HUD document that I understand was presented at Habitat 2 that mentions the elimination of private ownership of automobiles?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I certainly can. And this was a document presented officially by Henry Cisneros of our Department of Housing and Urban Development. It was a document called An Agenda for Sustainable Communities. It outlines in almost verbatim detail Agenda 21 objectives to transform the American lifestyle. Automobiles were only a part of it. It also calls for setting criteria for local building permits with detail to the extent that the building permit will require a homeowner to select materials that are approved, to site the house where it is approved, all the way down to the kinds of plants that can be planted in the yard for landscaping.
It is this is a United Nations plan?
This is a plan that originated with the United Nations, and it was developed further at Habitat 2. But the United States contributed to the development of that UN plan with a document called An Agenda for Sustainable Communities. And, of course, the Department of Housing and Urban Development participated with the President's Council on Sustainable Development, and their report, which is called Sustainable America, A New Consensus, contains all of these recommendations. There are 154 action items in that report that are now being implemented around the country administratively without any congressional authorization or oversight. I attended a meeting of the President's Council last November, which was supposed to have been their last meeting. I heard five cabinet members stand and say that they had tallied their action items and that they could implement 67 of the 154 action items with no additional legislation, and they were about doing it right then.
Okay, so basically what they're going to do then is just massively expand the control of government over every aspect of our lives, and really making it so difficult for people to build houses, they're not going to be able to do it. They're going to have to move into those little Chinese-like apartments that they have planned down the line.
That's the plan.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Well, I wondered if Mr. Lynn could tell us what this timeline has been like, when these ideas he was just talking about regarding housing and landscape, because so many things that have been being pushed on us by, say, the local building departments for the last 10 years or so seem to be just now appearing in UN ideas. And so it seems like... Well, these ideas were floated from behind the scenes a long time ago.
Oh, yes.
And now they're bringing them out to sort of make it legal now.
Yes. If you go back to the UN documents of the 1980s, you'll see many of these ideas first emerge. They originate out of three primary documents that are developed jointly by the United Nations Environment Program, the World Resources Institute, and the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and the World Wildlife Fund. These three NGOs work very closely with the United Nations Environment Program. They develop an extensive agenda of objectives, and then they come along with a treaty or a policy statement and have that approved by some world body. But they work very closely with other NGOs at the local level, at the national level. And these ideas then are lobbied for at the local and at the national level. And we are seeing many of these ideas implemented locally, nationally, and at the state level, sometimes even before, the treaty might be ratified. And that is very true with the Convention on Biodiversity. While that treaty has not been ratified by the Senate, it is being implemented as a result of the lobbying efforts of the affiliated NGOs.
Well, you're probably familiar with Executive Order 12986.
Refresh me.
Well, International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, January 19, 1996.
Yes.
Okay.
That executive order grants to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature diplomatic immunity for all practical purposes. That simply means that their records cannot be accessed by suit or in any other way by any American citizen. That is extremely significant in that the IUCN is the chief consultative NGO to the United Nations, and it is the NGO that is designated by UNESCO to evaluate all World Heritage Site and Biosphere Reserve designations.
And, of course, that's the United Nations, and many of the others are actually World Heritage Sites.
Yes.
Many of our national parks have already been named by the United Nations as heritage sites, and United Nations were actually brought over to consult to stop mining development a couple of ridges away from the United Nations, away from Yellowstone.
That's correct.
Anything else there, Mike?
Well, no, that's enough. Thanks.
Okay, fine. And incidentally, if any of our listeners would like to get hold of these executive orders, some of the new ones are even more scary. You can call us, and we'll tell you how you can access, or we'll put you in touch with Mike, and he'll tell you how to access these executive orders that have the force of law if they're not negated by Congress within 60 days. And I will tell you, the last couple of executive orders, which were really a blueprint for dictatorship and for everybody in the world to be tagged by under computer control, people have called the congressmen, and congressmen have said, what executive orders? They don't know what's going on. But that's why you need to listen to Radio Liberty. Let's go to Jeannie. Jeannie, will you hang on? We're going to have to take a quick break here. And then we'll be back with you right after we tell our listeners that if you'd like to get a copy of Henry Lamb's very excellent book, The Rise of Global Governance, A Chronology of the 20th Century, that has everything that you're going to need to be able to discuss this intelligently and point out the long-range planning of these wicked people who would destroy the land of the free and the home of the brave and supplant it with a socialist dictatorship, a socialist tyranny. Why, call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and simply ask for this. It's $10, $2 to cover the shipping, and then our tax on top of that. But I think it's important. It's something you can read, you can study, and then you have all the references you can go to, and they're beautifully done. And how many references are in that, Henry?
More than 103. I think there's about 130 altogether.
Okay, I think, we recommend it very strongly. Simply call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR right now. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. So nice to have Henry on. Henry, I do get your newsletter, Ecologic, and it's just top-notch.
Well, maybe we could just interrupt you, Jeannie, and Henry could tell our listeners how they can get Ecologic newsletter.
All you need to do is write us at Ecologic, Hollow Rock, Tennessee, 38342. And if you stick a couple of bucks in to help with the postage, we'll be glad to send you a sample copy. And you can see for yourself what we cover and how much depth.
Okay, go ahead. Jeannie, what was your question or comment?
Henry, I don't hear much of, as I understand, the United Nations is going to have a conference next year. I believe it's in March regarding banning or severely restricting civilian ownership of firearms. And as I understand, this was financed by a Japanese study. Do you know when that's coming up? And I haven't heard too much about that.
I have not heard much about it either. I know that there is an ongoing committee of the United Nations on disarmament. They were meeting in Geneva when we were over there last month, and they meet every 2 or 3 months in Geneva. Now, I do not have a 1997 calendar yet of all of the activities. But I'm glad you called it to my attention. I will see if I can find out when and where the meeting is scheduled and get more detail for you. If you'll call me at the office, I'll try to get some detailed information for you, Jean.
That sounds great. It's foremost in my mind because just recently our Board of Supervisors just passed a proposal.
Now, this is in Santa Cruz, isn't it?
Yes, Santa Cruz County. A proposal to ban Saturday night specials, which are the small handguns.
But that's just the first step. I mean, this is going on, and this is not happening just in Santa Cruz. Just by coincidence, it's happening over in Santa Clara. It's beginning to happen all over the country, but we're not hearing about it any more than we're hearing about what's happening in Australia. Any of our listeners would like to know what that is, you can send us a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'll tell you about the collection of the weapons that's going on in Australia as we speak, but totally blacked out by the censors here in America.
Well, I'll give you a call, Henry. Thanks so much for being on this afternoon.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you so very much, Jeannie. And, of course, we're talking with Mr. Henry Lamb, who's written The Rise of Global Governance. And, of course, Henry, don't you see this whole thing coming together right at this very time in history?
Oh, yes. There is a strong push to bring it all together by the year 2000. In fact, there has been a call for a world conference on global governance for the year 1998, expressly for the purpose of presenting the final treaties and agreements for ratification and implementation by the year 2000. This call comes from the UN-funded Commission on Global Governance, which, incidentally, Maurice Strong is a member of.
Okay, let's go to Judy here. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Dr. Stan. Mr. Lamb, thank you for writing this book. It just sounds like it's a wealth of information. I have a question. It's a broad question. Well, I guess it isn't too broad. It's rather narrow. Can you tell me, we always speak of these organizations, you know, throughout the world, internationally, and the people involved. Are there any kind of numbers that you can give us in regards to actually how many people are involved in this whole international, one world order movement? Is there any way that we could come up with a figure? I just out of curiosity. Thank you. I'll take the question off the air.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all of that question.
Basically, she wanted to know how many people are involved in this move towards world government. In other words, what percentage of the people are really in favor of this idea?
Actually, there's no way of identifying all of the individuals. However, in terms of percentage, it is a minute percentage, a very small handful of people, of individuals. However, those individuals are extremely powerful.
Sure.
And they are in governments, they are in foundations, and in major corporations. They are extremely powerful people, although they are few in number.
And of course, throughout the world, the communist leaders want it, the socialist leaders want it, the humanist leaders want it, the leaders of the corporate socialist movement, CFR, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberger Group want it, the leaders of Masonry, of Rosicrucianism, of Theosophy, the leaders of the New Age, like Al Gore. These people are all dedicated to this. They know what the objective is. They just don't want the American people to find out, because most people enjoy being free. There weren't very many people who wanted a dictatorship in Hitler's Germany, but they were all energized by the same thing. Hitler was energized by Theosophy. He was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky, just as the New Age movement all comes out of the movement of Madame Blavatsky. These occultic ideas, establishing a world government, and of course changing the religion of the world from the worship of our Savior Jesus Christ to these occult gods, this ageless wisdom. And basically, of course, what they're talking about is plain old Luciferianism. Now, Henry, do you think that they're going to be able to pull this thing off by the year 2000? Because that's always been the time that all the New Agers and occultists have talked about. And as I read my occult publications that come from things like the Lucius Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House, but now it's the Lucius Trust, they talk about the year 2000. Do you think they're right on schedule?
I think they're very close to schedule. I don't think that there is a chance that it will be totally implemented by the year 2000, but what is frightening to me is that we may be on the other side of the hill by the year 2000. In other words, they may be far enough along that there is no turning back. It will probably take another generation to get the idea of global governance fully implemented, but once our country has bought into this idea, there's no chance of stopping it.
And, of course, once the people are disarmed, that's so important, and that's what all this gun control talk is about. And once we've accepted all of these laws that, which will allow the government to regulate industry and regulate energy production and really take away the people's cars, and as one of our local legislators said, we have no choice but to go along with this smog check too. After all, the federal government's told we have to do it, and of course the federal government's going to say, but we have no choice, it's United Nations law.
That's right.
And of course everybody wants to pass the buck because nobody wants to take a stand.
Well, we have to take a stand. We have to protect our private property rights. We have to protect our education system.
But these people don't believe in private property. They believe in a ruling elite that controls everything.
That's right. It is their express objective to eliminate private property rights one way or the other, either by nationalizing land or taking control over it. There is an article in the winter edition of The Wild Earth, which is Dave Foreman's magazine, in which he presented the Wild Earth proposal, that explicitly says their objective is to take control of all private property one way or another, and they are certainly after it.
By conquest or consent, and that's
yes.
Just what James Warburg said so many years ago, we will have world government by conquest or consent. Well, Henry, we're just about out of time. Would you like to just spend a minute or so and just wrap up your thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share with your audience the concerns that we have and the information that we've accumulated over the last several years as we have researched this very important issue. And I would encourage your audience not to take my word because I say it, but to take the ideas that I have expressed and research them for yourself, because once you do, and once you believe how far along the international community has come in achieving global governance, it will activate you. And to get information, you can write to us at Ecologic, Hollow Rock, Tennessee, 38342. We exist for the purpose of researching these issues and providing information to our audience.
Well, God bless you for your work, Henry. And, of course, you know we're going to have you on as frequently as we can because you have so much to offer. And if we have the opportunity, we'll get you on to some of our other programs as well. So may the Lord protect you until we're together again.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. This is Dr. Stan, and, of course, Henry is one of the outstanding researchers on this subject. Remember, you can get his The Rise of Global Governance simply by calling our 800 number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, you can get that right now. Now, what really energizes this whole thing, of course, are the dark spiritual forces. Henry was talking about Colonel House. Well, you can read a book called Spiritual Politics, written by a couple of the country's leading occultists. And, of course, they will tell you that Colonel House was one of their people. What energized Colonel House and the way he was able to control not only Woodrow Wilson, but foreign dignitaries, Clemenceau, Orlando, the prime ministers of Italy and of France, the way that he was able to actually control everybody on the cabinet was because of these almost mystical qualities he had, which came from the dark side. You can read Circle of Intrigue by Tex Mars, and he has different references going into the background of the occultic background of Colonel House. And I spent weeks going through his papers back at Yale University. It was obvious to me when I did that that there was another sinister force behind this gentleman. But it wasn't until I began reading about the New Age and these occultic organizations, I began to understand what has energized this entire move.